Monster Man, Episode 441, Nymph and Octopus Comma Giant.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. We've got two classic monsters in this episode. It feels better when I say classic monsters rather than old monsters, doesn't it? But I don't say that every time. It's purely random, like there's no rhyme or reason to it, but in this episode, it does feel a little more appropriate because nymphs are from classical art and mythology, and I do feel like the Octopus Comma Giant is a bit of an adventure story staple. Let's start by taking a look at the nymph. Now, we've talked about nymphs before, and a lot of what I have to say about nymphs I actually discussed in a special episode about nereids, which you can go back to the archive and look for. But we talked about nymphs in season one as well. I really feel that your nymphs and your dryads and your nereids and so on are all kind of pretty much the same thing, right? These sort of female spirits in which the beauty of nature is expressed in the form of these stories have the hallmarks of being ones where, in general, women's perspectives are not considered very much, which is in some ways one of the reasons they remain kind of fascinating and challenging to us in the modern day, because we sort of impose slightly different meanings on them, and then the disconnects between those meanings and the texts actually can sometimes, I think, be quite fruitful. But that's maybe more than the D&D nymph will really support. In game terms, these are basically the same as they were in the previous edition, but enlivened by some nice Tony DiTerlizzi art. And I really like, actually, how DiTerlizzi does a good job of making the nymph seem beautiful, but also alien, because many other portrayals of nymphs or nereids or dryads are just like a pretty lady sitting near the feature that denotes, you know, so like a dryad is a pretty lady sitting next to a tree, and a nereid is a pretty lady in a pond. But here, DiTerlizzi has given her a kind of alien, otherworldly appearance, but still maintained, like exaggerated, the features that make her look, not just beautiful, but kind of like sophisticated. It's interesting. Maybe I just read her dress and hair that way. And the description does at least talk a little bit about her personality, calling her gracious and charming and so forth, in addition to her looks, although it certainly begins with her looks. There's a lot of slightly empty verbiage in this entry. So, for example, we're told that nymphs inhabit, like, places of natural beauty, and then we are given a list of what some examples of places of natural beauty might be like. But I can't fault this because it is at least sort of, it's inspiring, right? If you're creating a nymph encounter, boy, nymph encounter is a weird phrase, but if you're creating such an encounter for your game and you see Seaside Grotto or something, and you think, oh yeah, Seaside Grotto is a beautiful place. What if I put one there? You know, that seems fine to me. And interestingly, even with what some might uncharitably call padding, this does not extend to the full length of a page. This is a very short entry in the Monster Manual, as was the custom in those days. A lot was left for the GM to fill in those older entries, and I think for a lot of people, that was considered to be part of the fun. Anyway, there is a good amount of discussion about what you could use a nymph for in a scenario. For example, a nymph could be a rescuer when PCs are in trouble. Nymphs are quite reclusive and they avoid contact with others, but they're also good aligned, and if they happen across someone who is in danger, then they may try to heal them or help them in another way. Because they are very long-lived, or maybe immortal, I didn't check, but because they live such long lives, they often know things about, like, the ancient history of a place or about myths and legends that could be helpful. So they could be sources of lore, and in particular, of the kind of lore that doesn't get written down and recorded in some magician's library. So they could be, like, a good alternative sort of like folk memory source. So that's pretty cool. I want to make it clear that I'm not complaining about the fact that it's less than a page long. I think more of these entries should be shorter, but I understand that the format of this book means you can't then just put another monster on the page, which is what the Monster Manual would have done. But the Monster Manual had that thing where it was just trying to cram in as many creatures as possible. As always, and this is, I suppose, faithful to the mythology as well, the nymph embodies some sort of gender essentialist, heteronormative ideals about relationships. So, for example, nymphs are uniformly attracted to men. They will kind of invariably treat favorably. I do like that it just says favorably disposed, right? It's not they fall in love, but just that they are nicer to male characters with high charisma. And also, if we're going to accept this kind of thing, which perhaps you will and perhaps you won't, but if we're going to, it is nice that there is an additional bonus for female characters, right? So if we're playing within the boundaries of what's on the page here, the male character will have the nymph be favorably disposed to him, but women can use the nymph's magic spring or pool or whatever it is, and if they bathe in it, it increases their charisma. You know, I guess they come out of it looking especially lovely. So, that's nice, I suppose, right? That this encounter, okay, perhaps you don't agree with the assumptions behind it, but at least it's trying not to leave the female characters out, that they get something out of it. I called T'Challisi's nymph alien, perhaps unearthly is a better word. Anyway, you know the kind of thing I mean. She doesn't just look like a person. This nymph is fine. The nymphs in Greek mythology are just kind of a category to hold specific characters in, or a description of like a local tradition of nature deities, and they don't really fit the D&D model of a universalized type of monster. But if you were going to make them fit that model, then this would seem to be a pretty okay way to do it. Next up, we have the octopus, giant. Now, the octopus, giant is not just a regular animal, but is malicious and cunning, except for the entire rest of the entry, which demonstrates that it is just a regular animal. So that's not very clear. Octopuses, giant, or octopodes, giant, just to anticipate any tweets or Patreon messages I might get about this, but in general, I say octopuses. They are hunters who attack for food. Real octopuses eat, you know, fish, crustaceans, what have you. These ones are bigger, therefore they choose bigger prey. And that can mean people who are sort of alone and vulnerable in marine environments. So examples would be, you know, the one sailor on watch on board a ship or something like that. Some tentacles might snake up over the gunwale and try to get him. And I do think that that has other consequences in a way that is actually fun. So for instance, fighting a giant octopus is all well and good. You're slashing at the tentacles with your swords, you're trying to stop people getting dragged overboard, you're frantically casting water walk. That's all fun. But then also you could have that kind of consequences thing of, well, if the giant octopus drags the sailor on watch overboard, then as a result of that perfectly natural, just kind of like coincidence thing happening, what other consequences might there be? Where might you wind up if a, in this case, literal hand was not on the literal tiller? So they're fine. They're kind of an adventure story standard. Indeed, I think people are kind of fixated on the idea of giant octopuses much more so. Like, there are real species of very large octopus, but they're not aggressive. In general, octopuses respond to threats by going away from them, which is kind of what most animals do, right? The idea of fighting an octopus, I think just maybe to do with it having tentacles and so on, is a pretty common motif in sort of adventure literature. Whether an octopus or a squid, I mean, take your pick. And the idea of giant octopuses dragging ships down to the bottom, those would be bigger than this one, is something that persists in European art, you know, for quite a while. I mean, certainly can think of examples in the 19th century and earlier, and I'm sure I said all about this stuff back the first time that we covered the octopus common giant in season one. One thing that I don't think I knew at that time is that there was a sport, I don't know if it was a sport per se, of octopus wrestling that was popular, well, insofar as it was popular in the post-war US, particularly during the 1960s. And there was some, you know, magazine coverage of it and things like that. And there were like championships. And it's basically really just a form of competitive fishing. The idea is that you go down into the water and you have to grab an octopus and bring it to the surface with your bare hands, or your wet-suited hands, I guess. Those are probably bare, I don't know. The point is that it's given this name wrestling as if it were a form of combat, but these are not giant octopuses, just regular octopuses. So it is a somewhat uneven combat, which is the case with most combats between humans and animals in a sporting context. You know, they call it bullfighting, but I think if we were to look at the win-loss record, it would be pretty heavily in favor of the humans. Anyway, despite the misleading name, the idea of octopus wrestling is a pretty funny one. The scenario Lauren Song of The Bachelor has dire eel wrestling as a popular sport in the area, you know, something that, you know, young people do to prove their strength and courage, wearing special spiked bracers for the grappling. And I think there's some fun in that. You know, there's not a lot of, I'm trying to think, I'm often not a fan of kind of the naturalism of settings like Greyhawk of the Forgotten Realms or whatever, which have often been kind of overdone. I don't know if there are sports in those settings that are different from our ones. And I don't even mean, you know, magical sports, your Quidditches or whatever, but is there a game that people play that's just a little bit different from the ones that became popular in our world? I was looking at a list of what are the popular sports in a particular English county in the 19th century, or sports games. What are the popular games? I think we're mainly talking about like playground games. And there were all these games called like Jib Jab Jacob or Three Cooks in the Kitchen. And presumably they were just various kinds of like tag or ball game, but there's no reason that the specific game forms that we enjoy have to have turned out that way. So I think there's something to be said for being in a big city and everybody's like, oh yeah, no, you're not going to find a hotel room at this time of the night. It's ostrich racing day tomorrow or whatever. I think that could be really enjoyable, you know? Ooh, no, it's octopus wrestling championships. And again, you know, that helps you like find an NPC. You know, what do we know about this guy? Well, we know he loves octopus wrestling. Well, then he's definitely going to be at the Cephalopod Smackdown. All the greatest octopus wrestlers are going to be there. A big fan would never miss it. That kind of thing is fun. So yeah, the Octopus Comma Giant is absolutely fine. It kind of gives your games an adventure pulp feel when you do it, which I think is a feel that can be a lot of fun. So yeah, nothing wrong with that. All right, our next episode this week is going to be a listener request episode. So we're going to be taking a look at a monster inspired by, let's say, the myths and legends of Mesoamerica. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.